Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is If I Must Die, an evening in remembrance of Refaat Alarir and in honor of the publication of his book of poetry and prose, also called If I Must Die. The event took place at the Francis Kite Club in Manhattan on December 4, 2024. The Francis Kite Club is also home to Orr Books, the publisher of If I Must Die. Refaat Alarir was killed along with his brother, sister, and four of his nephews by an Israeli airstrike on December 6, 2023. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect my own views or those of this radio station. We'll start with author and actress Najla Saeed.
I'm going to read two small selections from Refaat's book. The first one is called Olive Tree. Just a textual note, it's spelled O'LIVE, tree. I think that's important. At first, I thought it was like an ode to Irish people, but it's actually, as I'm sure you've probably figured out at this juncture, O'LIVE, tree. Oh, beat me more. Hit me with your sticks. Step on my leaves. Smother my twigs under your boots, like how you always do. The beating I bear, the humiliation, I do not care. But take me not. Steal me not. Even if I burn, here I belong, and to them I shall return. If you hear my talk, you may feel my pain, but you belong not here. You do not even know how to touch me, how to gently squeeze me, how to hug me, how to wipe off the dust when I am ripe and when I am not, when I need water and when I do not, and how to pick me like how they always do. Your smell and heavy boots and the metal on your backs and your metal bars. For God's sakes, who on earth olives picks with metal bars for sticks? But I ramble again, because you won't understand, and if you understood me, you would not in the first place be here. You come and go. I see you once or twice a year with either flames or sticks, and I weep for the rest of the year. But one day, my twigs shall grow, the oil shall flow, my people shall glow, and you will go. October 15th, 2012. An Introduction to Poetry. This excerpt is edited from a spoken lecture delivered to students in advanced English poetry at the Islamic University in Gaza in 2021. We all know Fadwa Tuqan, the Palestinian poet, and please don't introduce her as Ibrahim Tuqan's sister. Let's talk about Fadwa Tuqan as Fadwa Tuqan. We always fall into this trap of saying she was arrested for just writing poetry. We do this a lot, even us believers in literature. Why would Israel arrest somebody or put someone under house arrest? She only wrote a poem. So we contradict ourselves sometimes. We believe in the power of literature changing lives as a means of resistance, a means of fighting back. And then, at the end of the day, we say, she just wrote a poem. We shouldn't be saying that. Moshe Dayan, an Israeli general, said that the poems of Fadwa Tuqan were like facing 20 enemy fighters. Wow. She didn't throw stones. She didn't shoot the invading Israeli jeeps. She just wrote poetry. And I'm falling for that again. I said she just wrote poetry. And the same thing happened to Palestinian poet Darin Tatur. She wrote poetry celebrating Palestinian struggle, encouraging Palestinians to resist, not to give up, to fight back. She was put under house arrest. She was sent to prison for years. Don't forget that Palestine was first and foremost most occupied in Zionist literature and Zionist poetry. When the Zionists thought of going back to Palestine, it wasn't like, oh, let's go to Palestine. It took them over 50 years of thinking, of planning, all the politics, money, and everything else. But literature played one of the most crucial roles here. This is our class. If I tell you, let's move to the other class, you need guarantees that if we're going to go there, we're going to find shares, that the other place is better, is more peaceful, that we have some kind of connection, some kind of right. So for 50 years before the occupation of Palestine and the establishment of the so-called Israel in 1948, Palestine in Zionist Jewish literature was presented to the Jewish people around the world as Palestine is a land without a people for a people without a land. Palestine flows with milk and honey. There's no one there, so let's go. Many Jewish people were disappointed when they came to Palestine. Number one, there was no milk and honey. And there were people. There have always been people in Palestine. So these are examples of how poetry can be a very significant part of life. Thank you.
That was author and actress Najla Said. Next is well-known author and activist Norman Finkelstein.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I thought I'd use the time allocated to me to address what you might call, for those of you who watch the program, the Piers Morgan questions. And even though people often snicker or ridicule Mr. Morgan for the questions, I myself thought they were actually valid, and I didn't believe they were easy to answer. So the first question, as everybody in the room knows, is, do you condemn what happened on October 7th? It took me a long time to work through that question, to think it through. And at some point, I reached the conclusion that the closest analogy to October 7th were the slave revolts in the 19th century. And for my own purposes, I found the most analogous, the Nat Turner revolt in 1831. It was the largest revolt in American history. When they went into largest slave revolt in American history, when they went into revolt, Nat Turner gave the order, kill all white people. And Mr. Turner and his Confederates proceeded to do just that. They disemboweled men. They chopped to pieces women. And in that case, unlike in Gaza, they did actually behead babies. So what do you make of it? That's the factual situation, but then there is the moral assessment of it. And I looked through the literature to see how different folks evaluate, assess the situation. And I found the most compelling, the most resonant, was a statement by what was called back then, appropriately for where we're situated, the New York Working Men's Party. And they had an organ called the Daily Sentinel. And the Daily Sentinel was a strong opponent of slavery. And this is how the Working Men's Party, this is how they reasoned through what happened. At least the microphone didn't explode. This is how the anti-slavery Working Men's Party reasoned through the Nat Turner revolt. It begins by saying, it becomes our duty today to record the particulars of an outrage more daring than any we remember to have heard of in this country. and one of more unjustifiable atrocity than any committed by the poor, degraded, ignorant blacks in Virginia. So it begins by stating it was an unjustifiable atrocity. But it continues. But we believe that the only effectual method of preventing the recurrence of such slave revolts is to speak the truth in relation to what has taken place, even though we are certain that it may prove unpalatable. Of what were the Negroes guilty? Of putting to death men, women, and children. For what object? Plunder? No, there is no evidence that such was their object. On the contrary, almost all the accounts concur in stating that they expected to emancipate themselves, and they no doubt thought that their only hope of doing so was to put to death indiscriminately the whole race of those who held them in bondage. If such were their impressions, were they not justifiable in doing so? Undoubtedly they were. If freedom is the birthright of men, as the Declaration of Independence tells us, unjustifiable atrocities? Yes. But were they justifiable in belief? Were they, Nat Turner and his Confederates, justifiably believing that it was only by putting to death indiscriminately the whole race of those who held them in bondage? And the author goes on to say, if such were their impressions, were they not justifiable in doing so? I believe that's the correct balance in trying to make sense of October 7th. Unjustifiable atrocities, but they believed that that was the only way they could emancipate themselves. And those impressions, based on their life experience, were valid. Now, the second question Mr. Morgan poses is, even granting that, what was Israel to do? Didn't it have a right to self-defense? And it took me some time to reason through that question. My own view, for what it's worth, is to consider this hypothetical. A woman, she's been battered and battered and battered relentlessly by her husband. She lets out screams of torment, of agony, hoping her neighbors will hear her, passersby will hear her, and come to her rescue. But all of her screams of torment and agony, they're ignored. She then summons the courage to call the police. The police come, they confirm all the details of her horror story. They write up an exhaustive report. They hand over the report to the judicial authorities. They take the report, they read the report, and then they deposit the report in the desk drawer to collect dust. One day, as her husband approaches her, she reaches for a knife and she stabs him. She stabs him once, she stabs him twice, she stabs him three times. He then reaches for his pistol and he kills her. He's arrested, taken to court, and in court, he pleads self-defense. Now, almost certainly, he will be acquitted in our court system. He will be acquitted of the murder charge because he was acting in self-defense. But that's the legal side. But there's a moral side. There's a moral question, which in my opinion supersedes the legal one. And that question is, after 20 years of tormenting that woman, after 20 years of tormenting that woman, did he not forfeit his right to self-defense? Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was author and activist Norman Finkelstein. Next up is Sarah Roy, an associate of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University. Sarah Roy will read a poem by Lisa Suher Majaj called Shroud of Light.
By the time they killed Rafat, there was nothing new about the rows of bodies rolled up in stark white shrouds, surprisingly unbesmirched by dust or blood, tied at both ends in neat bundles, sometimes in the middle too, so the sheet wouldn't slip, carried gently through streets on the way to mass graves. Those pits dug in whatever ground could be reached without the living being picked off by snipers. The unstained white of winding cloths belying the odor of carnage, permeating every crevice, miasma of death hanging like an ashen pall in the sky, clogging the lungs of those who still try to breathe. A newscaster said, children are meant to play in the dirt, but in Gaza, it's their shroud. Even that is beyond many. One Gazan wrote, if I die, please make sure my children's bodies are covered, not left open to wild dogs, the relentless howling sky. Lost beneath rubble, Rafat is denied a poet's burial, left only stone dust and concrete for his shroud. But the words that survive his death wrap his living spirit in a gauze of light. There's a Palestine that dwells inside all of us, he wrote. Take his words, inscribe them on a kite, brilliant white to fly high over the terrible world so that his death is a tale that brings hope, so that he lives, so that we live, so that Gaza becomes a place not of shrouds, but of freedom, kites rippling in sunshine, lit by the blaze of life. Thank you.
That was Sarah Roy, an associate of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University. Next, we'll hear from Academy Award-nominated actress Deborah Winger, who will read an essay by Rafat Alarir called Telling Stories, and an essay by Asim Al-Nabi called Kites and Candles.
Telling Stories. The 5 years that followed Operation Cast Lead were the most productive years of my life. As a young academic with the MA degree from University College London, teaching world literature and creative writing at the Islamic University in Gaza, I had great opportunities to be part of the struggle for Palestinian national rights. My job gave me the chance to work with some of the most brilliant students in Palestine, many of whom contributed to Gaza Writes Back, the anthology of short stories I was to spend over a year editing, to showcase Palestinian creative resistance to injustice and to Israeli racism and brutality. But how I got these requires a story about coming to understand the significance of stories. I remember vividly how I spent the 23 days preparing for the second semester because I believed there would be life after the offensive. I was rereading Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. And for the first time, it dawned on me how Friday's story was mediated by a self-appointed colonial supremacist master assuming ownership of a land that was not his. Crusoe's imperialist discourse had never before annoyed me like it did then. My island was now peopled, and I thought myself very rich in subjects. My people were perfectly subjected. I was absolutely lord and lawgiver. They all owed their lives to me and were ready to lay down their lives. I thought there had to be a different story that Friday could have told, had he not been silenced, and that we Palestinians should never be the man Friday of anyone, that we have to own our own narrative, and that no one but us can better reveal the sheer pain and suffering we are made to experience. If Israel's apartheid has to be fought, Israel's narratives have to be challenged and exposed. It was then that I realized much of my mother's wisdom. I read this a lot of times, not to do this. For years, she told me that my siblings, she told me and my siblings many stories. And many a time I gave my mother a grumpy, "How many more times are you going to have to tell the same story?" face as she retold the same story again and again. In response, my mother, who gave birth to 14 of us, 8 boys and 6 girls, me being the second eldest, started experimenting with the stories, not only by adding new interesting details, but also by zooming in and out as she saw fit to serve her purposes. The stories became more engaging. My mom, through the rare act of compromise, must have realized that the purposes of telling us stories are a lot more important than simply keeping us quiet or even correcting our bad behaviors, like making us eat vegetables because the boy in the story who did not eat was easily carried away by a giant fly. I cannot help but remember Mom's story about the lazy boy whose mother asked him to go out and see if it was raining. The boy replied, "Okay, when the cat comes in, I will feel if its hair is even wet." My usually multitasking mother dedicated her everything to the story when she was retelling it. The story appeared on her facial expressions, in her tone of voice, and through her gestures, and added solemnity to her already radiant face. My mother believed in her stories, and my mother's stories became and still are part of our lives. It was only later in life that I realized my mother's strong belief in the power of stories and understood that there are several ways to tell the very same thing. Sometimes my mother asked us to tell our own stories or even to repeat one of hers. The stories gave my mother more authority and power. Single voices, my mother must have believed, are blindly dangerous. As children living in the First Intifada, for us, the stories of my mother and those of my grandparents were our solace, our escort in a blind world controlled by soldiers and guns and death. In part, they are responsible for the person I am today, although very few might have predicted that the reckless stone thrower of the First Intifada would grow up to be an academic at university. Despite the attacks, or rather more accurately because of them, I found myself telling my 3 kids, Shaima, Omar, and Ahmed, either the same stories Mom told me or different stories with similar themes featuring my children as the heroes and saviors every now and then. Nothing broke the concentration except the intermittent boom, boom sounds. That was how I spent most of the time trying to make sure I was in the room least likely to take a hit from Israeli stray missiles. The stories I told my kids and my brother's kids who crowded the place and helped make the cold room warmer with their breath were not mere pastime pleasures, nor were they prepared in a scholarly way. They just came out. Stories in Palestine just come out. You decide to tell stories and the stories just appear. The characters start to gather and then everything, to the amazement of the storyteller, unfolds. If charity begins at home, so too do stories. As a Palestinian, I have been brought up on stories and storytelling. It's both selfish and treacherous to keep a story to yourself. Stories are meant to be told and retold. If I allowed a story to stop, I would be betraying my legacy, my mother, my grandmother, and my homeland. To me, storytelling is one of the ingredients of Palestinian sumud, steadfastness. Stories teach life even if the hero suffers or dies at the end. For Palestinian stories whet the much needed talent for life. And this I found one day back in September, reading Mondo Weiss, was an op-ed piece written by Assam Alnabi about his mentor. Today is Rifat Alyer's birthday. It has been 10 months since I lost my mentor and dear friend. I was with him on December 6th, walking along the open road when he told me that he was tired of this war. A few hours later, he was killed in an Israeli airstrike along with his brother, sister, and four of his nephews. A firm believer in the adage, the pen is mightier than the sword, no one knew Israel would deploy a missile to counter his wide-ranging tweets during the war. 5 months later, on April 26th, his daughter, son-in-law, and their newborn baby were killed in a similar way, in a similar airstrike. If he were alive today, I would not be writing this. Instead, I would be asked to join him at Al Khalaq, a simple but popular eatery along the shoreline near the iconic Al Khalidi Mosque, which was bombed on November 8th. Al Khalaq is known locally for having only a single item on its menu, crab. The word khalaq, ironically, translates to worry, but in Gaza, it holds a much deeper and uniquely local meaning, embodying several ideas in a single word that is integral to daily life in Gaza. Or if he was experiencing another busy day at work teaching English literature at the Islamic University of Gaza, we would meet at Ristretto Cafe nearby. We would have been celebrating his birthday, singing him songs while he was glued to his phone, as always, writing a tweet, relating an article, talking to a mentee, or coming up with a new idea for a meme, or maybe all at once. If the war hadn't happened, the children and university students would be coming back to their classes right now, and Rifat would be preparing course materials for them. He would inspire his students to write stories about their history and homeland to amplify the voices of their grandparents who never got a chance to learn to read or write after the forcible expulsion from their homes in 1948. Rifat would have either been busy at work reading, tweeting, simple but powerful thoughts, volunteering for a good cause somewhere, or finding time to sit with his eldest daughter, Shaima, and play with his newborn grandson, Abdul Rahman. I am wondering what he would be doing with his grandchild. Rifat's actions were always unpredictable. He was always our guide and mentor, and maybe that's what frightened them, that the young generation would have someone close who taught them how to wield their pens against the occupation, to expose its crimes and resist its racist apartheid system by any means possible. From challenging Israeli Hasbara to pointing out its glaring double standards, Rifat's writings were laced with humor, wit, and the occasional biting commentary that was hard to ignore. His accounts were restricted several times on social media platforms, which tried to suppress his reach, but he fought the bans and each time redoubled his determination to expose the crimes of the occupation. He never hesitated to amplify the voices of those who spoke the truth and to expose those who appeared friendly but were in fact deceitful. If Rifat were alive right now, he would be taking care of us. I will never forget his gesture just 3 days before I lost him. Rifat came over to my home where he heard my grandmother had passed. Our house in Al-Shujaya was still largely intact at the time, while he was displaced and moving between a school shelter and other people's homes. He came over on foot to say to me, "I am always here for you. I am by your side." So instead of telling you how much we miss him and the type of friend he was, I will continue to visit others and try to lift their spirits when they're alone. I'll encourage them to hold their heads high and endure like he did in his lifetime. I am still living and need to try telling this story. If his house had not been leveled to the ground, I would have sold some things, bought a piece of cloth and some string, and given it to an orphan child who misses his father. I would have asked him to fly it to give him a moment of hope. Instead, on many occasions, I have been that child myself, looking up at the sky, trying to find hope amidst the rising smoke, surveillance drones, and fighter jets. Dear Refat, I miss you so much, my brother.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was Academy Award-nominated actress Deborah Winger. Next is Palestinian poet and essayist Mosab Abu Toa, who will start by reading his poem, Under the Rubble.
Good evening, everyone. وَلَيْلٍ كَمَوْجِ الْبَحْرِ أَرْخَى سُدُولَهُ عَلَيَّ بِأَنْوَاعِ الْهُمُومِ الْأَبْتَلِي فَقُلْتُ لَمَّا تَمَطَّى بِجَوْزِهِ وَأَرْدَفَ أَعْجَازًا وَنَاءَ بِكَلْكَلِي أَلَا أَيُّهَا الصُّبْحُ الطَّوِيلُ أَلَنْجَلِي بِصُبْحٍ وَمَا الْإِصْبَاحُ فِيكَ بِأَمْثَلِي. These are three lines from Imru al-Qais, the most famous Arab poet from the 6th century. And I improvise these three lines because these were three lines that I and Rifat happened to be reciting together before we had some food in a restaurant about 3 years ago. I will read my tribute to Rifat instead of improvising, because I can't think that I can improvise anything about Rifat. Palestine is a story away. This is what Rifat Al-Ar'i wrote on my copy of the short story anthology he edited in 2014, Gaza Writes Back. The contributors were his students at the Islamic University of Gaza. When I published my poetry collection, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza in 2022, the first person I gave a copy to in Gaza was Rifat. I signed the copy by writing, Palestine is a poem away. Now Rifat is a world away. He was assassinated on December 6th by the Israeli army. The only weapon in his Gaza apartment was an Expo marker. If the Israeli soldiers were to raid his house, he said he would throw it at them while crying, we are helpless. Rifat and I loved strawberries. We used to go to Beit Lahi in North Gaza, which today, if you are following the news, today the Israeli forces expelled the last people who were sheltering in a school in Beit Lahi because the world failed them. They have remained in that school for 15 months waiting for something to end all of this. But there is nothing that was coming to them. We used to go to Beit Lahi in North Gaza, pick strawberries, then sit and eat. He would not forget to bring a lot of strawberries for his mother and wife, Nusayba, and their children. We would also sit in the open and play pun games. He would not fail to tease me and our third partner, Waleed Abu Sultan. I remember that in June 2015, Rifat messaged me asking if he could recommend my name to join the recently founded We Are Not Numbers, which aims to mentor and train young people in Gaza to become writers. I had sent him one of my early poems, to which he responded, "Mus'ab, I read your poems. I read your poem. It's very good. With more writing, more reading, more practice, you can write amazing stuff." I still have the message on my phone. In 2017, I told Rifat about the Edward Said Library that I managed to create in North Gaza. I showed him the picture I used to raise funds for the project and spread awareness about the situation in Gaza. It was of me holding a copy of the Norton Anthology of American Literature that I retrieved from under the rubble of the English department at the Islamic University of Gaza back in 2014, after Israel bombed the administration building. Rifat told me that it was his book. I would later think of Rifat as the co-founder of the Edward Said Public Library. The status of the two branches during the Israeli war remains unknown. So this piece was written a few months ago, but the two libraries were destroyed, including my own home library. Rifat and I were huge fans of FC Barcelona, the soccer team, and I was in Barcelona just last week, and I went to the museum there, and I wished that there would be only one person with me, Rifat. He would get mad whenever Barcelona was defeated. And he would start blaming the players, saying, "Why have we bought them?" And many times he would say, "The coach must resign." And Rifat loved to play ping pong. He loved John Donne more than any other poet. He loved to teach Shakespeare as well as Palestinian literature. Last December, I was in the United States, last December, which was December 2022. December 2022, I was in the United States completing my MFA program at Syracuse. Rifat hosted me at one of his poetry classes, and there is a recording on YouTube of that. He introduced me to his students and praised my book before discussing it with the students. Then we had a conversation. Rifat always urged his students to write their own poems and stories. Rifat himself was a poet and a short story writer, as well as an essayist whose writings appeared in the New York Times, among other places. And of course, now we have a very important book to have on our shelves. Rifat did not want to die. He loved life, he loved his students, he loved his family, and he loved food, especially ice cream. The last time I heard Rifat's voice was on the phone on November 27th, a few days after I was released by the Israeli army, having been kidnapped for 3 days. Rifat was furious about what happened to me. He generously asked if my family in North Gaza needed anything that he could offer. He told me about his car, that it was damaged. He used to go in that car to the restaurants and ice cream shops, as well as to the strawberry farms. But now there is no car, no restaurants, no ice cream shops, no strawberry farms, no Rifat. There is only this world that keeps watching our burnt bodies, our disfigured children, our wiped out neighborhoods, our devastated humanity. And just to remind everyone that today Israel attacked a tent area in Mawasi Khan Yunis, a humanitarian area, and 20 people were killed, including the family of a mutual friend of Rifat, Dr. Mohammed Lafi, who is doing his PhD in Germany. And then a few hours later, Israel bombed the 3 houses in Shari' al-Nafaq, al-Nafaq Street in Gaza City, and 25 people were killed from 3 families. So this was written about a year ago, and now the same things are happening. What Rifat asked of every one of us was to tell his tale. And his tale and those of others need to change this world, need to stop the genocide. It is not fiction. It is not poetry. It is this life. Rifat left us, but his words must not. The last time I was in touch with him was on December 3rd. I texted him that I made it to Egypt with my wife and kids, and that I felt a bit guilty because, I'm quoting what I said, "I'm now away from you and my family and the whole of Gaza. I cannot get in touch with anyone easily." Rifat replied, Don't regret anything. The only one who knows about your circumstances is you." I don't know how Rifat died, whether he was reading a John Donne poem or editing a poem of his own. I don't know what became of his body after the bombing of his house, whether his glasses got smashed, whether his soft fingers were clinging to a pen or to a flower he asked the world community to send to Gaza. I wish I had taken my copy of his book, Gaza Writes Back. But my house got bombed last month. That was October 2023. I lost all my books, including the signature of Rifat. I still foolishly hope that Rifat will come back to see a peaceful world for Palestinians, an end to the blockade and occupation, and a ceasefire that could bring water and food to the starving and bleeding children and mothers. So that was my tribute that I published last year. I wrote something. Thank you. I was working on something, and I'm going to read the part about Rifat because it is an important message. My dear friend Rifat Al-Arir was murdered last December with his sister Asma and his brother Salah, and as well as four nephews. That was not Rifat's only story. In April this year, Israel targeted his daughter Shayma, her husband Muhammad Siam, and Rifat's only grandchild, the baby that made Rifat a grandfather after his murder. I assure you, Rifat is not a unique story. Rifat is every one of us. When he said, let it be a tale, he meant it because his eye is the collective, the story of every Palestinian, every Gazan. I was struck to learn that very recently that Rifat's If I Must Die is a poem he wrote in November 2011, and that it was addressed to his daughter Shayma before he published it a few weeks before his murder last year. In this heartbreaking poem, the I and the you are murdered. Murdered with family. Rifat, the I, died. But the you, though Shayma was murdered too, becomes each one of us who read or heard the poem. I'm going to read one of my poems that's called Under the Rubble from my poetry collection, Forest of Noise. Under the Rubble. This poem was written after October 7th, and it consists of different parts. She slept on her bed, never woke up again. Her bed has become her grave, a tomb beneath the ceiling of her room, the ceiling a cenotaph. No name, no year of birth, no year of death, no epitaph. Only blood and a smashed picture frame in ruin next to her. In Jabalia camp, a mother collects her daughter's flesh in a piggy bank, hoping to buy her a plot on a river in a faraway land. A group of mute people were talking sign. When a bomb fell, they fell silent. It rained again last night. The new plant looked for an umbrella in the garage. The bombing got intense, and our house looked for a shelter in the neighborhood. I leave the door to my room open so the words in my books, the titles, and names of authors and publishers could flee when they hear the bombs. I became homeless once, but the rubble of my city covered the streets. They could not find a stretcher to carry your body. They put you on a wooden door they found under the rubble. Your neighbors, a moving wall. The scars on our children's faces will look for you. Our children's amputated legs will run after you. This part was written a year ago. And last month, I watched something very similar. Two fathers with bread around their bodies in a pool of blood. He left the house to buy some bread for his kids. News of his death made it home, but not the bread. No bread, death. Sits to eat whoever remains of the kids. No need for a table, no need for bread. A father wakes up at night, sees the random colors on the walls drawn by his four-year-old daughter. The colors are about 4 feet high. Next year, they would be five. But the painter has died in an airstrike. There are no colors anymore. There are no walls. I changed the order of my books on the shelves. 2 days later, the war broke out. Beware of changing the order of your books. What are you thinking? What thinking? What you? You? Is there still you? You there? Where should people go? This is the same question we have been asking. And even I think Piers Morgan in one of his interviews, where should people go? He asked the Israelis, give us a place. Where should my mother, my father, my cousins, where should they go to feel safe? This has been a question for a long time. Where should people go? Should they build a big ladder and go up? But heaven has been blocked by the drones and F-16s and smoke of death. My son asks me whether when we return to Gaza, I could get him a puppy. I say, I promise, if we can find any. I ask my son if he wishes to become a pilot when he grows up. He says he won't wish to drop bombs on people and houses. When we die, our souls leave our bodies, take with them everything they loved in our bedrooms, the perfume bottles, the makeup, the necklaces, the pens. In Gaza, our bodies and rooms get crushed. Nothing remains for the soul. Even our souls, they get stuck under the rubble for weeks. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza will looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze, and bid no farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself. Seize the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale. إذا كان لابد أن أعيش فلا بد أن تعيش أنت لتروي حكايتي لتبيع أشيائي وتشتري قطعة قماش وخيوطا فلتكن بيضاء وبذيل طويل كي يبصر طفل في مكان ما من غزة وهو يحدق في السماء ينتظر أباه الذي رحل فجأة دون أن يودع أحدا ولا حتى لحمه أو ذاته يبصر الطائرة الورقية طائرتي الورقية التي صنعتها أنت تحلق في الأعالي ويظن للحظة أن هناك ملكا يعيد الحب إذا كان لا بد أن أموت فليأتي موتي بالأمل فليصبح حكاية شكرا.
That was Palestinian poet and essayist Mousab Abu Toa. Next is Rashid Khalidi, who is the Edward Said Professor Emeritus of Modern Studies at Columbia University and the author of many books, including The Hundred Years' War on Palestine.
I think we're all deeply sad. Many of us are feeling what I would call survivor's guilt, that we have our grandchildren and Rifat never saw his grandchild, that we're alive and others in Gaza and in Lebanon are dead. But I want to try and lift our spirits a little bit. And I want to talk about two things. Many, many students have come to me at Columbia, which started a global movement that shifted the narrative in this country and in the world. And they are depressed. They are confused. Many of them, especially the Palestinians and the Lebanese, are suffering what they, one of them talked to me today about as survivor's guilt. They feel that they put their all into the movement, the encampment, the occupation, the demonstrations that they launched last year, last academic year, and that the war goes on. The killing continues. Mousab just told you what happened today. You can open up your phones and you can see the toll every single day. And they're depressed and they're confused and they feel that all that they did was for naught. And what I've been telling every one of them who comes to see me is that, first of all, this is a long struggle. This is not going to end quickly. This is something that's going to take a very, very long time. And young people who exerted themselves beyond the limits of what they thought they were capable of and achieved something world historical last year are now disappointed that the murderers are murdering, that the enablers in Washington are enabling, and that the death goes on. But I want to say two things. First of all, they did something that we should never forget, and we should continue to credit them for. They started something that has had a profound long-term effect. The narrative that they were fighting against will never be the same. Never be the same.
They cannot mouth those cheap, filthy, low lies the way that they have been doing again and again and again through the corporate and mass media, through the spokespersons in the National Security Council, and through the Israeli government's media. Those things don't work anymore. And it's partly because of what these young people did on these campuses. Starting at Columbia, continuing throughout campuses across the United States, and eventually all over the world. And I try and tell them this, and I don't think I'm having much of an impact on them. They're still depressed, but I'm telling them this is a long-term struggle. This is not going to end quickly. They're young, they're impatient, but I'm trying to make them see that we are actually changing the narrative. That's the first thing I want to say. They have done something that actually has never happened in this country before. I'm a historian. I can tell you that since Woodrow Wilson, that racist president who showed Birth of a Nation in the White House, who fired every black person in the federal government, that stone-cold redneck racist, ever since Woodrow Wilson, ever since the First World War, there has never been a time when American public opinion has been so negative towards Israel and has had any appreciation for Palestine. Well,
this is very important.
This is very important. It has not changed the elites. It has not changed the government. It has not changed the disgusting corporate legacy media. It hasn't changed the donors who run our universities, but it has changed public opinion. It will not change back. They cannot sell the old, lousy, worm-eaten goods. Land without a people for a people without a land. Making the desert bloom. Only democracy in the Middle East. That stuff doesn't work anymore. And it's partly because of work that's been done over many, many years, but it's by Edward Said, by Ibrahim Abu Lughod, by a whole host of people who've been working for decades. But it's also largely thanks to these students. And that's the first thing I want to say. We should not be discouraged. It is a depressing, discouraging moment. We read the news from Gaza and we say, we're in our 14th month. How can this continue? I lived through 10 years of war in Lebanon. Nothing like what they've suffered in Gaza. Nothing like what they've suffered in Gaza. But what one of the things we learned is it can always get worse, and it may get worse. It will probably continue. But there is a trajectory which is a trajectory of hope. And I think we have to keep that in mind. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is that what we've been listening to tonight in the way of poetry and narrative and stories and literature and acting and art and theater and movies is more important than what I do as a historian or what journalists do or what academics do. I mean, we've done our part. We've helped to change the narrative. But what people like Rifat, what people like Mus'ab are doing is much more fundamental. It gets the humanity of the Palestinians. It gets the narrative of the Palestinian people through, in a way, nothing I write, nothing Edward wrote, nothing any of us wrote can do. We played our part. I'm playing my part. Allah yarhamu. Edward played his part. Ibrahim, Allah yarhamu, played his part. And that's important. We've changed academia. The garbage that used to be published cannot be published anymore. That's the work of academics. But reaching people is not done through monographs. It's done through literature and art and film. And the stuff that Rifat did are going to continue that work. More things have been published in the last few years, memoirs, poetry, literature of different kinds by Palestinians and about Palestine than I've ever seen in my entire life. I was born in this city. I followed what was published in this country. Nothing was published of almost any worth, with a very few exceptions, for decades and decades and decades. And what's been published in the last 10 or 15 years is an amazing cornucopia. And people are reading it. The publishers wouldn't be publishing it if it weren't selling, ladies and gentlemen. That means there's an audience out there. That means people are open to a narrative that they never heard before. And the rubbish, the the stuff that used to fill their minds, the Exodus, the film, the book, that stuff doesn't work anymore. And what Rifat has written and what other people are writing is going to have an effect that none of us write the kind of things that I write are able to do. So I want to encourage you to understand that what we're doing here is something that could never have been done before in New York City or in the United States 10 or 20 years ago. These things didn't happen. These books weren't published 20 years ago. The fact that this is happening is, it's not a miracle. It's the result of a lot of people doing a lot of hard work, publishers, writers, journalists, in some cases academics. But I think the writers are more important. And that's why we honor Rifat al-Adiyyah, because I think he represents, with his pen, something that's going to lead sooner or later, inshallah sooner, but sooner or later, to the liberation of Palestine. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. That was Professor Rashid Khalidi speaking at If I Must Die, an evening in remembrance of Rifat al-Arir and in honor of the publication of al-Arir's book of poetry and prose, also called If I Must Die. The event took place at the Francis Kite Club in Manhattan on December 4, 2024. The Francis Kite Club is also home to Orr Books, the publisher of If I Must Die. Rifat al-Arir was killed, along with his brother, sister, and four of his nephews, by an Israeli airstrike on December 6, 2023. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.